we had some Beijing duck in Beijing.
In Beijing.
That was incredible.
That was just incredible.
Normally it's dry and fairly tasteless as far as I'm concerned.
Oh yeah, okay.
But it was really good.
All right, we'll have the mic for you.
Huh. Hello.
Do you want this or?
Yeah, that'd be better.
Or we can put it on this side.
Yeah.
For the tortilla thing.
Yeah. All right, what's the strangest thing you have eaten? What's the strangest thing you have eaten?
Pretty much everything.
Everything?
Yeah, pretty much. I don't bother learning the names. If it looks like I can eat it without dying or something. We were in Qingdao in a traditional restaurant, and I watched this older couple looking in a bucket, and in the bucket were worms and creepy crawlies and something else, and they were picking out their meal of what was in the bucket. And I just wanted to throw up.
In the bucket.
Yeah. And, but in the restaurant, you picked out what you wanted to eat. And that looked terrible. But they were very excited and were pointing at the summer.
You should start business. Grab a bucket, put random things in there.
And see what happens.
Yeah. All right, well, here's the first question, which is related to last night, if I can read it correctly. Does the woman should be man's helper mean like women should do the housework, raise kids, while the man watches TV? It works.
Wow. Works. There is something that is forgotten in modern culture, and it should be remembered when you read the New Testament. In the ancient world, the typical woman had 12 kids. On the average, 12 kids. They were able to figure that out from gravestones that would list such things in the Mediterranean world. And of those 12 kids, half of them died before the age of 5. So that when you compare the modern woman with the woman of the ancient world, we're talking about two absolutely different worlds. And the world we have now, with women, married women, typically having less than 2 children, would be utterly incomprehensible for the ancient world. If you don't have birth control and you have the possibility of having 12 kids, you have absolutely no choice but to take care of children and be at home lest they kill themselves if you're not around to take care of them. So in a sense, without birth control, the answer to that question is relatively easy, because Bana, I'm waiting for a reaction from my Bana. Thank you. Now go back to your cell phone. Bana not only means to build something beautiful, it's the word for building a family. And that was the context of what God and Adam and Eve were talking about. Now in the modern world, the book of Proverbs takes great delight in women who are effective, intelligent, and skillful, and just rhapsodizes about the kind of woman who is intelligent, works hard, and is skillful, so that taking what you find in Proverbs, particularly with the woman of valor, that is what she's called. The answer to that question would be not necessarily at all. I mean, if you have 12 kids, it would be wise to stay home to take care of them. If you don't have 12 kids, and if birth control is used, well, then you have a greater opportunity to do something in the world outside of the home. There's two figures of women in the book of Proverbs. One is folly, one is wisdom. And the Hebrew culture had no problem whatsoever in using a woman as a figure for great wisdom, which tells you something about the culture. And also reflects Hebrews chapter, not Hebrew, reflects the Hebrew of Genesis chapter 2, where again, Achzer is a divine
type. What is the difference of love between a believer and believer versus husband and wife? I think sense of belief, like a community of believers, I guess that's my sense of that question.
Try that again.
What is the difference of love between a believer and a believer? I'm assuming versus referencing community, like a Christian community, versus husband and wife.
In the talk this morning, I talked about the Song of Solomon, and there are three characteristics of romantic love, which becomes married love, and the three things are character, passion, and chemistry or friendship. And the chemistry or friendship is the delight that people have in one another. And the character, obviously, is what is asked of married people and church members. But the middle one, passion or sexual passion, obviously, that would not be a wise thing to have proliferating through the church, but it's an excellent thing to have in marriage. But it's really interesting that the term ahava, shall we have them all pronounce it?
Sure.
Ahava. Ahava. Well, let's say it together. Ahava. You guys are uninspiring. Let us try it again. Ahava. It sounds like your dog was run over by a car and is dead. Let's try it again. Ahava. Your second dog died. Well, I'll take what I can get. Ahava is used of romantic love and God's love, and the common element within that word and in the word agape is plain old delight and enjoyment. Very plain old delight and enjoyment. And after all that, what was the question again?
What is the difference between the love between
okay.
the believer and
yeah. So that ahava can be romantic love or it can be the love of God through people. And the common element, the core of it, is plain old delighted enjoyment. I'm fascinated by the young man who is trapped by those chairs and is probably suffering great injury because he looks like he's under a pile of chairs. Are you all right? Oh, good. I was worried. Yes.
Why do you struggle with the agape love, the unconditional love, the love that God likes in us? Why do you think people struggle with that?
Well, it's epidemic among the Chinese. It's semi-epidemic among Caucasians. But there is this absolutely insane belief that love is loyalty and love is earned. It's a totally insane belief, but it has a powerful force in the Asian culture, and it has some force in the Caucasian culture. And because of instinct, which are created by the culture and created by the family, words change. Because words take their meaning from context. If you're growing up in a culture which is performance-based, if you're growing up in a culture where love is loyalty, and that we prove love by what we do out of loyalty, then when you hear that aside from what we do, right or wrong, that God loves us, enjoys us, and wants to rescue us from sin, simply out of passion for us, it doesn't hit any emotional chord within. There's no piano key in the heart if love has already been defined as loyalty and performance-based. There's no music that comes with that word. And it's, I think it's one of those areas where the culture has beaten the daylights out of the church. Meaning the culture has had more power in the church than the church has had within itself. The culture emphasizes performance-based love, loyalty is love, earning love, and also that if you receive a gift, you have to give a gift back pretty much of the same value, meaning there is no such thing as a free gift or affection without earning it. And to me, it's the cultural issue that's the challenge.
Can you provide some more examples of that?
Sure. My favorite example is this. A woman, a Chinese woman, we're at a church in the Bay Area. It's not your church, so the illustration's not, I hope it's not your church. It's not your church. after I talked about I gave a talk on a gift is a gift. There are no strings attached. This woman came up and said, Chinese woman, she said her husband was very ill. And three men from the church came and visited her and her husband and prayed for her husband and were concerned. And then they left. And over time, her husband recovered. Well, she felt so terrible that she had no means of repaying these three men who visited her that she found herself praying that one of them would get sick so that her husband could come and visit and pray for that sick husband. And when she was telling me this, she said, I know this is crazy, but that's exactly how I feel. They came, they were kind, they did it out of love and affection, but I felt obligated to respond in some way. And so I'm finding myself praying that one of these guys get sick. Well, that just shows the power of it. Or another illustration is a woman from Hong Kong was describing her mom, and she said that if somebody would visit her mom and gave a gift to her mom, and the woman was leaving the apartment, the mom would grab something to give her back as a gift and run down the hall and try and get to her before she got to the elevator so that she could give a gift in return. And the sense of spontaneously giving something freely out of love and affection is wiped out by the culture. The culture assuming that love has to be earned and love has to be reciprocated, and that love doesn't start out with delight, but it starts out with a choice, which, as far as I'm concerned, I would call it a heresy, because it is really undercutting God's love for the world and for people. You follow? Okay.
What would have happened if Adam and Eve didn't lie to God about eating that fruit?
Now, is it is the question, what if they hadn't eaten the fruit, or what if they hadn't lied?
Why don't you answer both those questions?
Okay. Let me give you some background. And the background is this. Before Satan ever showed up in the person of the snake to tempt Eve, he had had a record of losing 2-1 on tempting other spirit beings. In the book of Revelation, it says that Satan was able to tempt spirit beings who inhabited the universe, and 1/3 of them followed Satan. 2/3 didn't listen to him, didn't believe him, and stayed loyal to God. So when you look at the temptation of Adam and Eve, you've got to look at the record that Satan had, which was largely not a good batting average. Only 1/3 of the time he was able to lead somebody down the path. 2/3 of the time he was turned down. So when Satan showed up with Adam and Eve, it was not a foregone conclusion that they would just fail, because 2/3 of the time Satan failed in his temptation. You with me so far? Okay, good. You with me? Okay, 2/3 of the time he failed. So there's no, you cannot assume that they would have necessarily failed. And also remember that God gave Adam Eve, and for those of you who are familiar with the Old Testament, Eve is actually a wisdom figure. That temptation is a wisdom temptation, meaning the temptation that Eve succumbed to was to become wiser, because she was wise already. And she was given as a consultant and a helper like God to help Adam not make a dreadful mistake. She was the resource for Adam. So in a sense, you got to put two things into the equation. One is, 2/3 of the time, Satan failed. And then secondly, there was a backup that Adam had in Eve, who was supposed to help him, which might explain why Satan went after Eve instead of talking directly to Adam. That story is really strange, because as far as the Hebrew text is concerned, when the temptation took place, Adam was physically present and was hearing the whole thing, but Satan was not saying a word to him. And Satan was talking to the woman because he knew he needed to nullify the helper like God in order to get anywhere. It's sort of wrapped into the story that she was there to help, almost like a divine help with the woman. So the first part of it is that that temptation was a true choice, and if Adam had said no to Satan, then he would have been like a Job who was set up by God as an example to Satan in the book of Job. And human history would have been entirely different. Adam failed. He took all the rest of us with him. And we ended up with the mess we got. So the second part is, what if Adam had hid? Was the question lie? Yeah, well, it's really hid. Yeah, he didn't lie when he got caught. He blamed Eve, and he sort of blamed himself weakly. But he hid. If he hadn't hid, if he had gone to God and told him what had happened, he would have practiced 1 John 1:9. He would have confessed his sins. He would have been cleansed. Fellowship would have been restored. But unfortunately, God was left in the position of having to chase him down, which made the whole thing worse. So if he hadn't hid, it would not have been as wretched as it turned out. But the important part of the story is that temptation was not a setup for failure. It was a setup for success by having Eve there. But unfortunately, Satan negated Eve before he went after Adam. I always get a kick out of smiling at people who don't smile back. Yes. Yeah. Oh, good.
My two daughters would do that when they're babies. You know, part of those mirror neuron studies is babies.
Yeah, just smile back.
Reflect whatever you're reading, so I would do the tongue out in the studies. And they actually would say,
pretty cool.
So you should have a kid yourself, you know, these.
Yeah, so they can mimic you.
Let me ask you, like, kind of an overarching question. So you turned 70 this past year, right?
Yeah.
And you lived, was it most of your life in the Bay Area, or?
Well, at the age of 22, I came out to the Bay Area. Okay. So most of my life in the Bay Area.
So as a pastor, as a shepherd, what is your sense, like, what are some things, looking at the change in the Bay Area in the last, let's say, years now, right? What are the things that concern you about the Bay Area, and what are some things that you are optimistic about?
Well, I'd like to say, for the fun of it, I'm not optimistic about anything. However, after coming out with that, what are the things that concern me? The beauty of actually living for three generations, a generation is typically 25 years, the beauty of having lived for three generations is you recognize that there is such a thing as a cultural wind, meaning that the culture changes, and it's like the force of a wind. It just keeps pressing and pressing. And Paul referred to that as the wind of doctrine, being blown about by every wind of doctrine. And in a sense, when you recognize that cultures change, that actually gives a sense of great hope. Because we're presently in a culture in the United States and in Europe that is going into insanity at the speed of light. The mark of insanity is when a culture can say, we really don't see any difference between male and female. And the problem with that is that humanity ceases to exist when male and female cannot be differentiated. Because the basic definition of humanity in the Bible is male and female. It's the essential component of humanity to have a distinctly female person, a distinctly male person, and you can't have humanity without it. It is the lowest common denominator of what it means to participate in the human race. We have a culture that says you can have any gender you choose to be, which on the face of it is a totally insane, crazy, unintelligent thing, but yet it appears to be said by most intelligent people, which adds to the beauty of it. When intelligent people are saying crazy things, it creates a cultural wind, a force, and people will easily succumb to that force because it sounds like the best and the brightest are saying these things. I'll give you an illustration if you're interested in things like that. Are you interested at all in sex change operations?
Yes.
Oh. Okay. Sex change operations. There is a research project that comes out of, I believe it's Johns Hopkins, put together by three reputable medical doctors who are also psychiatrists, who did research on people who have had sex change operations, and they have concluded that that is not a healthy thing to do to a human being because it doesn't solve the problems that led the person to wanting a sex change operation. And it's a major, major article put out by superbly qualified people based on a whole group of different research projects. And I will guarantee that not one major news organization in the United States will carry it. It will not show up on CBS News, NBC News, ABC News, simply because it doesn't fit the cultural wind. Yet, it is true news, it is important news, and everybody, whether they agree with it or not, should be aware of that of that particular study. But we live in a culture that where the best and the brightest are determined, that those they view as less than intelligent should agree with them. Now let's go back to the original question as I go wandering along. The original question is? So that's the negative side, that we live in a ridiculous point in history where the genders are being negated. The positive side is the early church was in a vastly worse situation culturally because the Greco-Roman culture makes our present culture look pretty virtuous, meaning the culture that the church grew up in was horrendously worse than modern culture. They not only practiced wholesale abortion, they practiced infanticide, or the killing of babies, and it was no big deal. And the church was able to change that culture profoundly over a period of 300 years. It's one of the most incredible transitions in world history. So what would be the point of that? It's the church is the most powerful institution on the planet if the church allows itself to be the church. And the church, if it can change the Greco-Roman world, can change anything. But two generations back, if people from two generations back, if they were watching a modern TV set with modern shows on, they would think they'd been transported to a different universe, totally different universe, and would have been absolutely shocked.
So what would you encourage, like, certain characteristics of men, biblically, this is kind of what you should develop or, you know, be more of as a man, and for men, women, but this is what you, because you're saying there's that gender confusion, and,
yeah,
and culture is kind of getting into that, like controlling who you, what kind of gender you want to be. So yeah, what roles in these genders would you say, because I'm sure this, you know, because I think there's some confusion on some people, they feel penalized for being too masculine, or they feel penalized for being feminine, but biblically speaking, what would you say are good ones to sort of focus on?
I'm always curious with interactions in the room, so I saw some response over here to something over there. And I didn't catch it, but it's always entertaining to try. It's like the, watching the flight of a bird. Just what's going on? Anyway, if you were to describe Christ as a male, you would combine two words that begin with C, and the words would be courageous compassion. If you studied the descriptions of Christ in the Gospels, the most common word which is used for his affect, for what they saw in him emotionally, was compassion. He liked, he was comfortable with, he understood and he felt where people were at, and he was incredibly courageous. And what made him courageous was compassion, affection, and understanding. And out of that compassionate understanding and love flowed courage. So I would say that the characteristics of the Christian male should be a person who, a male who is courageously compassionate. Now this is where mirror neurons comes in. The male has to make a pilgrimage from just analyzing people's emotions to actually feeling people's emotions and begin to compassionately understand people. So that would be describing a male with some characteristics. The female, I would say, has to understand that Hebrew word ach is there, because it is the greatest compliment that God gave to the couple. Meaning, the man was not given a divine title. The man was made in the image of God. The woman was made in the image of God. You have to come up with a title for the man in Genesis 2. And I had to create one called the Purposer. But in Genesis 2, the woman is given the divine title Achzer, which means a helper like God. It is an astonishingly powerful comment, and explains why when you go into the book of Proverbs, women or a woman is used as the figure of what is a truly wise person. So that, what would I say a Christian woman should recognize is that She is a tremendous gift to the people about her, and she should not be trapped by many cultures, including the American culture, can sometimes relegate women to second-class status. And the church does that. So that recognizing the range of capacities that God has placed in the woman, the title that God has given that woman, out of that sense of, I'm to be taken seriously, I have an awful lot to offer, she should then be motivated by love to actually serve, which is, for Christians, is a wonderful, noble word.
Any last questions? What's your favorite color? My 9-year-old girl.
What's my favorite color? My wife told me it was blue, so it must be.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the reason why my wife must tell me that is because I'm slightly blue-green colorblind. I'm not one of the 11 that are truly colorblind, but I'm slightly blue-green colorblind. And it is the weirdest thing to look at something and go, is that blue? Is that green? What color is that? And it would be a kick if you could be inside my brain as I'm trying to figure out that what is that word, Hopkins? Is it Hopkins?
Yeah.
See, I look at that and I go, is that green? Is that
blue?
It's blue. Just the way you're saying it, I don't trust you. You jumped too quick. But it really is weird to not be able to actually land on blue and green.
And so, like, how sweatshirt would you, can you see that as blue, or is it, what color does that look like to you?
That looks like blue. But there'll be certain colors, like that Hopkins thing, where it's sort of shaded. I'll look at that and go, I guess that's green. It's a strange deal.
So it really is gappy, you can see that figure, or even then.
I'm pretty much assuming it's green. I would go with green with that. Now, here's what happened, is the women in this room and the men in this room have a different ratio of what are called rods and cones in the eyes. In the back of the eyes, there's this thing called rods and cones. And young women have a different ratio of rods and cones than men have in ratio of rods and cones. And because of that difference in ratio, men can more quickly recognize movement than women, but women can more quickly recognize texture and color than men, particularly texture. And when a child is born, if it's male or female, it pretty much determines the ratio of rods and cones in the eyes. And it also determines the range, what's the best approximate range for hearing the human voice. And women have the best range for hearing the human voice.